First, we return to our look at the candidates in the race for governor here in Washington. We heard from Sammy Byrd earlier this week, who got the official endorsement of the Republican Party. Today, we hear from the candidate who did not get that endorsement, former King County Sheriff, former member of Congress, Dave Reichert. I asked him to explain what happened with the Republican Party convention, and here's his response.
Well, it was a mess. What happened was I took a principled stand. And I did drive to Spokane, was ready to go to the convention. The staff said there was total chaos, advised me not to enter the building because there was so much confusion, chaos. I might even create a bigger problem. So I went to a friend's home and communicated back and forth Thursday afternoon at 3, there was a meeting. They disqualified my opponent for some admissions to a criminal offense.
This is Sammy Byrd you're talking about.
Yes, sir. And so they disqualified him for bank fraud, identity theft, and basically based it on his confession to Jim Bruner and on his own podcast. There was concern that they went out into the convention and I was the only candidate. Mr. Byrd was off the slate, that there could be some a riot, disruption at least anyway. So they were considering a way to disqualify me. And the best they could come up with is that I, and Dave, you know me well enough, I don't really go along with the crowd too much. I didn't sign this pledge to drop out of the race if someone else was endorsed as the Republican candidate. So I didn't sign the pledge. So they decided, well, let's disqualify him for not signing the pledge. However, there was no rule that required that I sign the pledge. It was a totally optional. And they then soon discovered that if they disqualified me for not signing the pledge, they'd have to disqualify about another 20 Republican candidates for the same decision. So then they decided just to remove the entire gubernatorial nomination process off the agenda for Friday, which eliminated my speaking role. So that was supposed to occur on Friday. They were supposed to send out an email to the delegates that he was disqualified and include the reason. They first then decided not to include the reason. Then they secondly decided not to send the email and decided to announce that he was disqualified when the convention opened on Friday. They announced that, but they all had taken a pledge of non-disclosure as to the reason why. So then chaos erupted on the floor demanding to know why Mr. Byrd was disqualified. And then I was told, as a result of the disruption, Mr. Byrd was going to be allowed to speak and that I would be allowed to speak. So I put my suit on and was ready to head out. And then they decided that neither one of us was going to speak. So this continued to, and then they changed the rules to allow the floor to make a motion to reinstate Mr. Byrd, even though he had already been disqualified. And so I stood on my, I just took a principled approach to this, that this was a, it was a sham. The rules continued to change to sort of accommodate the outcome that certain people within the party wanted to see happen. And I just decided not to be associated with that sort of a chaotic, dishonest mess.
So bottom line, he did not get the official Republican nomination, but of course he is running anyway and will run, he says, as a Republican.
Yeah, I'll keep the Republican moniker, but I you know, people in King County especially know me. I'm not a bomb thrower. I don't go after people. You and I had a pretty decent fair a conversation and debate about the issues, and that's where I intend to be. And you know, my goal is to attract as many voters from both parties and from the independent world to win this race in November.
One other thing circulating is some comments that Reichert made during a donor event concerning same-sex marriage. There's a video in circulation saying he believes marriage is between a man and a woman. So I asked him to explain what he was trying to get across.
Yeah, well, you know, it's there were a lot of other comments made prior to that statement and post that statement. Bottom line is, I really believe that God has given us all free will, and we have the right to choose whom we love and what kind of family we want to build. And so I support the LGBT community and would defend their right to continue their choice to love who they want to, live where they want to, just like any other citizen of Washington State.
So when you made that statement, you were just saying that for you personally, that's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, that's my personal belief, but it's not my mission to push my personal belief upon anybody.
Candidate for Governor Dave Reichert. We had a pretty long talk. We'll be posting the whole thing at mynorthwest.com. Choke points.
Let's go.
97 winters have taken their toll on the Snohomish Bridge in Everett, and that means it's time for a makeover. Here's Chris.
And a spot paint job and a little lubrication isn't going to be enough this time around to keep the bridge in good shape. The Washington Department of Transportation is getting ready to shut down the northbound span of the bridge, which is part of Highway 529 between Everett and Marysville. They're about to shut it down for 4 months. But before that happens, WashDOT is going to have to reduce the northbound direction to just one lane.
We're going to reduce the northbound bridge down to one lane starting Monday morning, and that's going to be the prelude to a full northbound bridge closure, which will come up at the end of May.
WashDOT's Tom Pierce says that four-month-long closure of the northbound span expected to start around May 28th.
We really need to get in, do some more work on the steel, some of the work on the mechanisms that make the bridge function, and then, of course, we want to repaint it too, because painting is an important part of taking care of a bridge. It helps keep the steel in good shape. And this bridge is 97 years old. We've painted it a few times already, and this is going to help keep it going.
When that full closure begins, both directions of 529 will be using the southbound span over the Snohomish River. The work on the bridges along 529 isn't the only construction, though, that's going on between Everett and Marysville. As we've been talking about for years, contractors are in the middle of a massive improvement project on I-5. That new northbound HOV lane is under construction between Everett and Marysville. So is that whole new interchange at I-5 and 529 that will provide new on and off ramps to the freeway. Part of this work is concrete improvements on I-5, and this weekend WashDOT is preparing to close lanes for this. Northbound I-5 expected to be reduced to just one lane from Friday night through early Monday morning in downtown Everett.
We are going to remove some asphalt pavement and we're going to replace it with concrete. And so that takes a lot of time because we need the concrete to cure, and then, of course, we have to go back and restripe once that's complete.
And, of course, there are going to be ramp closures involved with this. Now, this concrete replacement work is weather-dependent, and looking at the forecast for the weekend, it doesn't look very good for curing concrete and restriping. So I'm expecting maybe to get some word later today what they're going to do in terms of pushing that off to another weekend. As for now, WashDOT expected to open that new interchange into Marysville and the new HOV lane in the fall of 2024. And that one is going to have a huge impact on that daily drive we have getting up into the Marysville area.
So I was talking about paint. Have you checked out the high rises on the Mercer Island floating bridge eastbound lanes lately?
No, I have not.
Well, they're rusting. And didn't I miss this like a year ago that it was time to repaint those?
Well, maybe we could ask Sound Transit to throw a couple of cans of paint. They're already out there, just
that's
not on
true.
That particular lane.
Don't we have a drone that paints now? We
not
can just
yet.
Fly it over
not
there?
Yet. Oh. That's not, hasn't been approved. And that's
tested.
Only for graffiti.
Well, that was the graffiti drone.
Right.
But why not? That's a good point.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Why not?
If you can go after graffiti, why not use it to paint a hard-to-reach bridge?
Well, maybe because I have the answer for you. It took me a second for it to click. In order to minimize the environmental impact of painting the bridges over water, and especially like we have, they have to wrap the inside of the bridges to make sure that they can contain the paint.
I see.
Generally kind of when you get a paint job, they bubble the bridge, and that's to prevent any environmental damage to the lake.
Can't you just train painters to be careful?
Just they can do that. I mean, the old days of just throwing a line over the thing and have them sit there and paint it like they used to paint the Navy ships during World War II. But I think things have changed there.
After the three-eyed fish showed up, they were like, maybe we got to make some changes.
Yeah, well, and, you know, maybe OSHA might have something to say about about that as well.
OSHA doesn't cover drones.
Who knows? Not as far as we know. Who covers drones right now? I know the FAA's involved, but I'm sure they don't have... Yeah, who's going to control that airspace? They're trying to figure that out.
Let's look into the case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court involving an abortion ban in Idaho. For an exception of the law and how it can impact abortion around the country, Erin Carr teaches law at Seattle University. Her emphasis is on unenumerated constitutional rights, which are the rights that are not explicitly written out in the Constitution, but are generally found as intrinsic rights by the court. And according to Carr, this case in Idaho includes a conflict between federal and state law.
So I think it's important to note that even though this case is a direct result of Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which rescinded constitutional protections for abortion care, this particular case does not implicate a constitutional question. Rather, it's an issue of statutory interpretation. So what we have here is a federal law that was enacted in the 1980s, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, commonly referred to as EMTALA. And this is a federal law that requires that doctors who are at medical facilities and hospitals who receive federal funding have to stabilize or treat any patient who shows up in their emergency room. And so here, the Department of Justice is asserting that Idaho's near-complete abortion ban conflicts with EMTALA because under the abortion ban in the state of Idaho, there are criminal penalties for doctors who provide emergency abortion care where a pregnant woman's health may be at risk, but her life isn't necessarily at risk.
And that's what the justices were really trying to get at with their questioning. There was an exchange between Justice Sotomayor and Coney Barrett, where even Coney Barrett was going, hold on. This seems to be going too far, because one doctor's opinion of what's a life-saving emergency is different from another doctor's opinion of a life-saving emergency. So they were basically saying, so a woman has to lose organs, a woman has to have long-term health effects, she has to be on death's door before you provide an abortion. Can you talk to me a little bit about the questioning of the justices and what that may implicate on the outcome of this case?
Yeah, and the Idaho Solicitor General acknowledged as much, that this is a subjective standard. And that seemed to be quite concerning to particularly the female justices. Mm-hmm. And so I think the concern here and the questions that the justices were asking of the parties is really intended to determine what is the minimum standard of care for a pregnant woman requiring medical treatment, and who decides? And if there is a conflict between this federal statute and Idaho's abortion law, under the Supremacy Clause, the abortion ban will not be upheld. And yet, there seems to be some disagreement amongst the justices, and there's a clear gender divide here regarding whether there is a direct conflict or not. And what is particularly fascinating is the argument that the state of Idaho is putting forward in defense of their abortion ban. And they're essentially saying that EMTALA does not require a specific type of medical treatment, let alone abortion care. And so therefore, there's no conflict.
And explain that to me again.
Yes. So according to the state of Idaho, what they are arguing is that the Idaho Defense of Life Act does not directly conflict with EMTALA. And that's because they are not providing abortion care to anyone, right? And under EMTALA, their claim is we are not required to provide emergency abortion care in order to be compliant with this. And the Department of Justice's position is that that is not feasible, that there are pregnant patients coming to emergency rooms in the state of Idaho who require emergency abortion care to be stabilized to comply with federal law. And instead of providing that emergency care, the state of Idaho is essentially transporting those patients out of state in order to get that life-saving, stabilizing care.
We're hearing from Erin Carr. She teaches unenumerated constitutional law for Seattle University. And the big question here is, if a doctor has a patient come in who requires an abortion to save her life, does the doctor have to wait until her blood pressure reaches a critical point before legally being allowed to perform an abortion? And according to Erin, that puts doctors in Idaho in an impossible situation.
That's because the Idaho Defense of Life Act provides for very, very narrow circumstances in which abortion will be permissible. And that is where the pregnant person's life is at risk, not necessarily their health, but their life. And so many providers in Idaho do not feel that they are empowered to provide emergency abortion care unless it is pretty much a given that this pregnant person is on death's door. And Justice Sotomayor was very much focused on that point during oral arguments. And so where there's the potential for really significant long-term dire health consequences, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the woman's life is at risk. Under the narrow circumstances, under the abortion ban in Idaho currently, medical providers cannot treat pregnant women by providing them with an emergency abortion. And so consequently, these women are being airlifted to places like Utah, to Washington State, where these restrictions aren't in place and they can access this necessary medical care.
We aren't saw there... this happen in COVID, too, where even people who needed treatment for COVID in Idaho came over to Washington State. Can states like Washington or Utah, taking on the bulk of these patients and costing their medical systems money, can they sue Idaho?
That's a great question. And Washington has very much positioned itself as a sanctuary state, particularly for abortion. So we have policies that are encouraging and allowing out-of-state patients who need this type of care to access it in the state of Washington. And there are resources being provided to accommodate those out-of-state patients. And yet there's no doubt that it is placing a strain on our reproductive health care system. What we're going to continue to see as these disputes amongst states regarding abortion laws continues is interstate conflict. And I think it is perfectly reasonable to expect that you are going to see states suing one another regarding how their state laws might interfere with another state's abortion restrictions or abortion access legislation. So we should expect that there is a potential for interstate conflict over abortion rights and abortion access generally.
Erin Carr, Seattle University School of Law. You can hear our full conversation with her at mynorthwest.com.
And we talked a lot after the interview, too, and she mentioned that there are already real-world implications from this. One in five doctors in Idaho have already left the state. Six women had to be airlifted out of Idaho for this exact reason. So these, what she called fringe ideas of fetal personhood, it used to be just this fringe alt-reality idea, are now becoming mainstream. And women are at death's door because of it.
This is being played out now in the real world.
Yes.
We're going to see whether
this isn't fake.
Yeah, that's right.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness is brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Students in New York are feeling ducky. They're attaching messages of kindness to cute little rubber duckies and placing them around their neighborhood with the goal of making someone's day. Jada Morgan, who wrote Be the Wave of Kindness in Someone's Day on her duck, tells local TV station WKBW.
That's really important because you never know what somebody is going through.
Jada is hoping her message reaches the person who needs to hear it most.
being positive and being kind can really cheer somebody up. And I believe that if you put positive energy out into the world, that'll come back to you.
Madeline Figueroa wrote Be Original and says she wants people to embrace who they are.
Just to be themselves, not follow other people, not like everybody else.
They said random acts of kindness are important because you never know who needs that positive message.
That's not usually always the case. Sometimes there's something deeper inside of them, but being kind will help them out.
Have you ever noticed how something as simple as, I like that outfit.
Yeah.
Your smile is nice. Even when a stranger said, you just notice how for the rest of the day, your mood is lifted. A simple little message.
That never happens to me, that somebody looks at me and says, I like that outfit.
That's not true. Yesterday, G was giving you all the props for being dripped in REI.
I was dripped in REI. He didn't say he liked it.
That's a compliment. Dripped, yeah.
I see.
That's. I believe we can confirm. I mean.
No, leave it at that.
Okay.
I'll just leave what's coming. Let's return to our look at the candidates in the race for governor here in Washington. We heard from Sammy Byrd earlier this week, who is the official Republican candidate, got their party's endorsement at a contentious convention. Today we hear from the candidate who lost that endorsement, former King County Sheriff and former member of Congress, Dave Reichert. Longtime listeners may recall that Dave beat me in 2004 for the 8th Congressional District race. A fairly contentious contest, 52% to 47%. Not that I remember the exact numbers. But we had quite a cordial discussion over some of the issues. And one of the big ones was, okay, suppose you're a former law enforcement guy, former King County Sheriff. What if there's another CHOP incident here in Seattle, and let's suppose someone named Trump is president and said, okay, we're gonna help you out, Seattle. We're going to send federal troops in to help you. What would Reichert do as governor in that scenario?
Well, Donald Trump and I'd be on the phone rather quickly. there's no federal troops coming into Washington state. We have such a thing as state rights. And I would remind any president decides that sort of action is necessary, that there is a separation of federal government and state government, and we have the right to address our own problems within our own state. And we would work together with the people of Washington state to resolve an issue like that.
And what would be your stand on such demonstrations, and in particular, people who block the freeway?
Yeah, I made that clear, too. I think you remember I was the sheriff during WTO.
I do remember that.
Yeah. And as you know, the last thing we need to do is to let things get out of control. And I think we're watching some of that play out across the country today with our universities and some of our communities across the U.S. and even here in Washington state. I firmly believe that people in our communities today want to see law and order, want to see people held accountable for their actions. Here's the difference between a protest and an occupation and or the violation of law, Dave, and I know you understand this clearly. That is, we all have the right to express our First Amendment right. No one argues with that. If you have a viewpoint that you want to express, feel free to do that, but you have to do it in a peaceful, respectful way. You do not have the right to destroy property, break into buildings, vandalize buildings, vandalize monuments, assault people, threaten people. Those are violations. Those are law violations, and they need to be enforced. You don't have the right to stomp on the rights of other people to express your First Amendment right. The First Amendment right doesn't say, yes, your viewpoint is very important, and so you can go turn over a car and burn a dumpster. No, you can't do those things. So peaceful protest is one thing. And I think we're seeing too today, Dave, that some of the people who were in, well, I'll just compare WTO. Some of the people involved in WTO, we later learned, were anarchists that came in and began to stir the crowd, which was mostly peaceful. And in today's world, we've seen now in New York, they took some action there, and they've also discovered that there were people in the middle of those protests that began a small group of people changed a peaceful protest into destructive, violent protest. And the other thing is, I'm very concerned about just the whole idea of anti-Semitism and the words, racial slurs and words that are being used across the board.
We're hearing from Candidate for Governor Dave Ryker. In case you're puzzled by the WTO reference, 25 years ago now, wow, 1999, the World Trade Organization met here in Seattle. The Ruckus Society, I think it was called, hung banners from cranes. There were organized protests. There were riots. I was doing a talk show at the time. We were, and a bunch of reporters were in the middle of all of that. And Dave Ryker became famous because he took off on foot chasing looters who had stolen a TV set downtown.
Wow.
And became known as Batman on my talk show. Anyway, the next issue, homelessness. How would he handle that?
Well, you know, I'm sad to say, back in the day, Ron Sims, Norm Mailing, and I, along with a number of other community members, were on the committee, King County Committee, to end homelessness. I left probably 5-6 years into that. Of course, as you can see, homelessness did not end. I think there were some things in that committee I learned that could be useful today. And apply today. And I see some organizations are applying some correct solutions and some that are really showing results. And I think that's the key, is that we need to spend our money wisely when it relates to homelessness, because it really boils down to two things. Number one is substance abuse. And number two would be mental illness. And of course, as we all know, that in some cases, an individual may be suffering from both of those conditions. So, and visiting with the Union Gospel Mission and a group called The More We Love and Mary's Place and several others across the state, from Spokane to Seattle to Kent to Auburn, it's really boils down to, how do we address the two major causes of homelessness? And I really like a model that's being used by a number of organizations, and that is you'll give people a place to come. They come in and they're asking for help, because we're walking by people on the street, and I know you've seen them too, where they're totally incapable of even standing up, and let alone making a decision that's good for their health. So we're expecting that, we're asking people, do you need help? And expecting an answer, yes, I need help, when in fact they're not capable of making a conscious decision that benefits them. So we have to help them.
Candidate for Governor Dave Ryker. Full discussion on MyNorthwest.com and the Ross Files podcast. We also talked about immigration, the war on drugs, abortion. By the way, he acknowledges abortion is a settled law here in Washington State, would not attempt to change that, and also graffiti. So check out the Ross Files podcast. And that's time for G. Scott from the G. and Ursula Show. The mayor announced this week he's hiring an outside investigator to look into claims of gender discrimination and sexual harassment in the Seattle Police Department.
Yeah.
I'm surprised this is still going on, but I guess I shouldn't be. So can you bring us up to date on this case? Where do these latest allegations come from?
Yeah, first, the mayor has no choice. He basically has to, the people here in this area need to figure out and find out if what is going on is true. What's going on right now is this. Like you said, four female SPD officers filed a $5 million tort claim accusing the chief, Adrian Diaz, and his top lieutenant, John O'Neill, for discrimination, sexual harassment, and hostile work environment. Where we are, and by the way, of the four women, two of those women have been on the force for combined 70 years.
Jeez.
So I don't want you guys to think like, well, were they new? Again, let me say that again. Two of the four officers, lady officers, have been on the force for a combined 70 years. here we are today. They're asking for independent review. The mayor tapped the independent investigator to look into these claims of gender discrimination, and also says that that they will find out if any needed systemic recommendations will be based on the review, and if the findings and the recommendations will be shared with the Seattle City Council, and once the review is complete. Here's, I want to bring this part up, and here's the part where I got to say, like, I could not believe my jaw is still to the floor. There was a statement that was actually to Cairo News Radio by the SPD Office of Public Affairs, and basically what they said in that, to sum it up, was claims of, let me get to this point. Oh, here we go. Excuse me. The tort claim calling the allegations personal attacks rooted in rough estimations of hearsay, which reflected individual perceptions of victimhood unsupported by investigations. That came from the SPD Office of Public Affairs, which is interesting because the person that is in charge, the head of SPD Office of Public Affairs, is one of the people that's part of the torts claim, which is Lieutenant John O'Neill.
Yikes.
Huh. Like, you can't make that up. So the fact that that statement, instead of no comment, which is usually the normal thing, the fact that you make that statement, you basically just showed, at least you showed me, oh yeah, there is a problem there. There's a real problem just based on that response.
Yeah. Well,
individual perceptions of victimhood.
Well, but what I read, there wasn't any perception involved. It was pretty overt, wasn't it?
The claims?
The claims, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it wasn't like a misunderstood joke or anything. This was like physical stuff.
But it sounds like they're trying to spin it as victimhood, right? So yeah. We have the evidence. And then we have the statement.
The statement, but let me, I don't think you guys heard me right. The SPD Office of Public Affairs released that, actually put it on paper.
Calling their four officers.
Individual
victims.
Perceptions of victimhood. So, but yet the SPD officers are talking about discrimination, sexual harassment, and hostile work environment. That statement alone proves the point.
Yeah.
So I'm glad.
Well, that should be an easy investigation.
Well, I am glad that the mayor is bringing on a third
party
to come in here. I think that that's the only way that they're going to get to the bottom of this.
Watch, we'll find out that one of the investigators used to be part of SPD. Like, it always goes that way here in local news, right? Where it's never just clean. We can never just have a clean investigation. Mm-hmm. People who are unbiased to the situation. There's always these inner workings. And so I hope this comes through because these allegations continue after Me Too, right? Like it didn't calm down. It didn't cool down. Women now feel empowered to say, no, that wasn't right. Mm-hmm. And I would like compensation or whatever it may be for what I endured for how many years were they on the force?
Two of the four officers have a combined 70 years of service.
They have protected and served our city under all of these situations, sexual harassment. And now they're saying, okay, I feel free to speak up. I want justice here. Mm-hmm. And that's the statement they put out. It's time to wipe the slate clean.
I couldn't believe that statement. And you know, you would think out of respect, you would think out of, you know what, we want to make sure that a proper investigation is being done, that this would been have perfect time to say, you know what, we don't have any comment. We don't want to comment about any type of litigation with the media. But you make that comment, that statement. And so that lets me know, like I said, there is a problem. All right. Good morning to you guys. I didn't know I was going to come on here and come to go serious, but sometimes you have to.
Yeah,
good morning.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.